Support for the Exchange podcast comes from you, our sustaining members, and from New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Across the country, the racial demographics of COVID-19 are the same. Black and Latinx Americans are more likely to become infected with the virus, to need hospitalization, and to die from it. These trends are reflected in New Hampshire, prompting the governor in late May to form a COVID-19 equity response team. The group had 1 month to analyze the situation here in the state and come up with recommendations and a report. The bottom line, the group says, is that access to health care is just a small slice of a much more complicated picture. Today in The Exchange, three members of this team join us. And listeners, let's hear from you. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or you can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Bobby Bagley, Director of Public Health and Community Services in Nashua. Also, Kirsten Dersey, Evaluator for the Bureau of Infectious Disease in the New Hampshire Division of Public Health. And Dottie Morris, Associate Vice President for Diversity and Inclusion at Keene State College. Well, a big welcome to all of you. And Dottie, let's start with you. It's been so often said that this pandemic has highlighted and exacerbated the problems that already long existed in American society. And Dottie, I wonder what you think.
Yes, good morning to everyone. Yes, I think that what this particular pandemic has done is unearth the things that several people have known has been at the bottom of the foundation. And I think that part of what we're seeing now is kind of the manifestation of the years of ignoring those underlying factors. And so you have individuals whose health is already compromised, and then you put on top of that something like this pandemic, you could see why the numbers vary because of the health disparities that existed long before the pandemic made its arrival.
What jumps out at you the most in terms of that, Dottie? You know, you mentioned health disparities, but as you guys say in the report, it's so much more than that.
Right. Right. I think that the whole thing is the level of denial that we have within the United States about the impact of inequities, especially when it comes to economic inequities and the impact that that can have on the quality of life someone is able to have. So the type of food you're able to obtain, healthy food, the type of activities you're able to engage in, the where you get to live, the type of air quality you have within your home, all of those things have an impact on our health. Also, I think we deny the impact of racism on people's daily lives and the over time, the impact that being constantly exposed to racism, be it overt or covert or implicit, regardless of how it plays out, that it has an additive effect. And over time, one's body is compromised by that. And that compromising piece of a person's system, when a pandemic or when a virus like this comes about, you can see how just merely exposure to continuous stress can compromise the body and therefore make someone more susceptible to contracting this virus.
Yeah, there's been so much written now about the stress effects of just living in this time and how that's going to have health effects on us all down the line. And picking up on what Dottie said there, Bobby, this report at one point calls racism a public health crisis. So make the connection, please, for us, Bobby, between racism, public health, and coronavirus.
Yes, good morning, Laura, and thank you for having me on the show this morning. Racism is a public health event, and the impact that we see is shown in the health indicators, or what we see with the predominant health indicators that we have been trying to understand, address, and overcome and close the gap with our population groups. And so when you see increased hypertension, diabetes, even with lead poisoning, asthma, when you see numbers increase disproportionately in certain population groups, and then you can go back and say, okay, so there are these factors, socioeconomic status, we say, okay, so they're making the same amount of money, people are making the same amount of money, and yet we still see high rates of low birth weight babies or high rates of asthma in certain population groups because of race. That's where we see this as a public health issue. And as it was pointed out, we've seen this greatly manifested with COVID because of the impact of these structural factors where individuals that represent certain racial groups don't have the same protections that the majority population has. And so that's how we see this as a public health issue. It's not just something that's, you know, can be identified, you know, that we have a technical fix for, or a simple issue. This has become a complex public health issue that everyone needs to focus on.
Well, and several states have formally declared, Bobby, as I'm sure you know, racism a public health crisis. Should New Hampshire do so, Bobby? I mean, how much would that declaration matter?
It matters because when you think about any health condition that impacts a small number of individuals, that's going to have an impact on your whole population. And so, yes, the state of New Hampshire should look at and address racism as a public health issue, because anything that affects one small part of our population group in the state impacts the whole state as a whole.
Well, and Kirsten Dersey, I want to bring you into this. You've been looking at the data. So what do New Hampshire's numbers show about the effect of this virus on our state's residents of color?
Well, good morning, Laura. Thank you for having us here this morning. So I think it was important for us to think about what we were beginning to see nationally and what we anticipated that we may see here locally as well. And that's that this pandemic, like others before it, like other public health crises, would impact particularly communities of color in much more significant ways and disproportionately. And so one thing that we've been able to do over the past months is look at our data. We had to start by ensuring that we had the right variables available to us, and specifically that we were capturing and collecting race and ethnicity from individuals appropriately, because if we don't have that information, we can't really look at where our disparities exist. But we have been able to increase that data significantly over time. And so what we are seeing in New Hampshire is very much in many ways in line with what other states and the nation is seeing as a whole. And that's that infection rates and hospitalization rates are significantly higher for Black and African American residents in New Hampshire, as well as Hispanic and Latino residents in New Hampshire. And our infection rates sometimes as high as, you know, five times the amounts that we're seeing in our population of people who identified as white. And so, for instance, in our Black and African American communities, currently we have in our state, they represent about 1% of our population, but they represent almost 5% of our cases. Wow. And in our Hispanic and Latino population, that's an even more significant gap. They represent about 4% of our population, but almost 14% of our cases currently.
So, Kirsten, you're a data person. As I said at the beginning of the show, you're evaluator for the Bureau of Infectious Disease in the New Hampshire Division mm-hmm. of Public Health. What did it mean to you to serve on this team, to dig into the data, but to also really talk about all these other social and economic factors that Bobby and Dottie mentioned?
You know, this was really a great honor for me to serve on this team with this group of people who I've worked with and deeply respect. It really was a call to action, and it meant a lot, because it meant that we were not only going to have a platform to be able to dig in and talk about what we were seeing, but also a wide platform to be able to make some significant recommendations. And so, you know, we can look at the data, we can see the issue in front of us. And I think what we tried to do in the report was really provide some background context that Bobby and Dottie both talked about a little bit earlier, and that's the digging into the why. Why are we seeing these widening gaps? Why do we see these significant disparities? You know, why is there an issue of a disproportionate access to care, or the ability to socially distance, or the ability to access testing? Like the why of that is the critical part of this equation. And I think that if we only focus on the data, we sometimes lose that part of it. And the answers for how we move forward exist in the why.
All right. And we're going to focus on the why and the how and the recommendations this hour. And I invite our listeners to join us. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, today in the Exchange, we are talking with three members of the governor's COVID-19 equity response team, which had a very brief time to analyze why the racial demographics of COVID-19 are the way they are, with Black and Latinx Grant-Staters much more likely to become infected, to get sick, to die from this disease. We welcome your questions and comments. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can always use Facebook, or you can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. So as all of you have alluded to, we are tackling some enormous issues here beyond healthcare itself, you know, getting in to see the doctor, housing, jobs, all of that. But the report also does say there are some steps that could be taken right now. So I want to ask everybody, but Bobby, you first, please. What are some of your top two or three right now actions?
So Laura, some of the top things that we're looking at right now are the idea and the ability to bring on some community health workers. Community health workers are essential to helping address and connect people to services, help us better understand the diversity that's within our communities, you know, as well as be that liaison between the service provider, the community, public health, and every, you know, aspect of an individual's life. And so that's one piece that we have known for a while that was really important to engage and increase our capacity to address. And so in the report, we talk about this essential component of our workforce. And, you know, for years in New Hampshire, we've had individuals that have worked, you know, in this role, but not in a way that was significantly highlighted. In fact, many of them have really gone very much underrepresented, but we've known the impact that community health workers have had in our state. And they've had different job titles, outreach workers, peer educators. And so where we can formalize or have been looking to formalize this workforce and give that title of community health workers to this group of fantastic liaisons that work in our organizations. They work in public health, work for community-based organizations, and we're looking to increase the number of individuals in that workforce throughout the community. So that's one of the top
Yeah, it's interesting. And actually, could I jump in, Bobby?
Sure.
Nashua has two of these, right, already? Yeah. Two community outreach workers. So
yes.
Yeah, just tell us what they do. You know, just describe their sort of daily role. And by the way, how common or uncommon is it for a city to have two of these workers?
It's not uncommon. So for all the time that I've worked in public health, and I started back in 1997, we've had outreach workers working for the department, and they do various things. They work across our programs for HIV prevention, lead poisoning prevention, asthma, STD, and have played a significant role in what we've been doing with our COVID work around testing, contact tracing, investigation, outreach, and getting information out into our community. So on a daily basis, our community health workers, both of which are Latino, so they speak Spanish and English, you know, have helped us to connect to our Spanish-speaking population in a great way. And when we go out to do testing in the community, they'll go and they'll knock on doors. They'll let people know that we're in the community. They can communicate in the language that the community members understand. And so that helps bring that collaboration, you know, together, working with the community. And that's what their role is. And then they work with us as the, you know, the healthcare professionals, if you would say, the public health staff. But they're well-trained as well. So Luis Perez and Robert Ortiz are the two community health workers that we have, you know, at the National Public Health Department. And we've had others in the past, but they play a significant role in helping us make those connections and working with our community-based organizations as well. So they're like the foot soldiers and the liaisons between all of the pertinent stakeholders, which the community is an important part of that stakeholder relationship in getting work accomplished and getting information out there and helping dispel myths and misunderstandings and disinformation that's out about COVID, about testing, about the disease itself, and about who should get tested, where they can get tested, and why it's important for them to get tested.
Wow. Well, Dottie, how would you answer that question? Some of your top two, one or two sort of right now actions.
Well, forever the educator. I would think that one of the main things that I would like for us to start on as immediately as possible is looking at ways that we can provide educational opportunities, especially for those people in power to understand how the decisions that they make will have an impact on individuals ranging with a wide range of social identities. And I think that that's a key piece because we only know what we know. We don't know more than what we know. I'm saying the obvious. But I think that there are times when decisions are informed from one worldview without taking into account other worldviews. And we could see the effects of that in how decisions play out in real life, where it ends up benefiting only one group of people. So what I would like to see happen early on is that there is some format by which people in positions of power can learn what does it mean to make certain decisions that they make and where are those decisions coming from. And this is not about anybody being good or bad. This is about doing a really critical analysis of oneself, understanding how power plays a role. When you combine power and decision-making and the outcomes, you could see how it could have an impact on the quality of life for people. The second thing I would like to see happen is somehow, some way, have more attention to organizations, particularly nonprofits that are run by people of color that serve people of color. So they are trusted by people within their community. Those are the people that are the village mothers or fathers, in quotes, that people go to for help, and they have these small nonprofits. And because of the way that the criterion is set up, sometimes they don't meet that, yet they're still providing a very valuable service to support the other things that are available out there. So those are my two big things.
Well, and there's a lot there. So yeah, so I'm interested, Dottie, Bobby mentioned Nashua's outreach workers, as she put it, you know, working with community members to dispel some of the myths and misinformation about this disease, how to combat it, testing and so forth. What are and misinformation, Dottie, that you hear perpetuated, especially among the communities that this report focuses on?
Well, I guess, you know, I mean, I want to make sure I understand your question, because is the misinformation within the group or is the misinformation about the group by people outside of the group? Because those are two different questions, because I think that some of the misinformation that I hear about the groups, you know, relate to very kind of personal things like, you know, maybe, you know, the level of cleanliness that individuals have. That's a piece of misinformation I've heard that leads to the conclusion. That's why more people have that. Within the group, I think that there once again, misinformation or distorted information or whatever we're going to call it, is just related to, you know, where to go and who can I trust? I think that Bobby is really good at really laying that out, is this idea of who do I trust and how will I be received when I go to get the testing or when I get certain advice, or where can I go to get other sorts of things to make sure that I am prepared in so many ways. So I think that the question, I want to make sure, I was trying to answer it both ways because I didn't know if you meant misinformation within the group or about the groups.
That's interesting. And I meant within the group, but it's very interesting to hear you talk about misinformation about groups. And one other key recommendation that I saw in this report that's repeated throughout, and Kirsten, I'm going to turn to you, is data. The report really says we need more data, we need better data. Why is that so important, Kirsten?
Well, I think, you know, in this report, when we're talking about a pandemic, although it sort of amplifies and lays bare inequities across lots and lots of different sectors, we did focus a lot of work in the field of health and public health in particular. And I think for us in public health, you know, data is the language that we speak. And it is sort of how we communicate what we're seeing, what we're doing, why we're doing what we're doing. And so data becomes really important. Data alone, I think it's really critical to talk about this. Data is not, people are suffering, people are dying, and data is not going to save anybody's life. That is important to say. But the data can inform the decisions that we make, particularly decisions related to policy and service delivery. And so it becomes really critical. But in this report, it was really important for us to talk about what does it mean to think about data in a more equitable manner? How have we traditionally collected data? What does that look like? Who's captured in our data sets? Who's missing? And what voices are missing? Are there other ways to think about the data that can inform the work that we do across, you know, within government, outside of government, in organizations large and small? And we think that there are ways to do that. We think that it's very important to think about capturing first-person narrative from people who are impacted and amplifying those voices, not speaking for, but amplifying the voices of people who are impacted significantly. We think about issues around how we analyze data to ensure that we're really stratifying and looking at different populations in different ways to ensure that we're, you know, providing the clearest picture that we can. We think that, you know, it's significant for us to think about our historical record within public health and outside of public health of often looking at marginalized populations from a very deficit-based narrative. So we're collecting issues about disparity or lack of access or poor health outcomes, but we're also, it's really important for us to really think about these populations having significant assets as well around resilience and community and care for each other and thoughtfulness and knowledge. And we need to be able to amplify that voice as well. And then, you know, finally, if we're collecting data, how are we disseminating that data? How are we utilizing it? Who is getting that data first? Is it going back to the communities that it's most important to? So, you know, I think data, you know, has a very sort of one-tone connotation to it, that it's just numbers on a graph. And those numbers are important. Those numbers represent people and experiences. But there are other ways to think about data. And I hope in this report we are able to make that issue clear.
You know, it's interesting, Kirsten, because while calling for more and better data, the report also says the race categories often to label people, track data, figure out what's going on, are problematic. I'm quoting from the report here. The report also says these race categories are, quote, fraught with complications. So how are these categories problematic, even as you and others in public health need them to figure out what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, they are problematic because, you know, we talk about the issue that race is really a social construct, and historically race has been collected and racial categories have been identified in some very significantly problematic ways over time. It's become in you know, over time for various reasons, who lands in what racial category or what racial categories exist can often be politicized for various reasons. You know, there are people who identify and experience the world in certain places in the world as people of color who may not have a racial category that we can identify as a person of color currently. For instance, Middle Eastern and North African people are collected under the category of white, but I think it's clear that in many places in the United States, including New Hampshire, they're often experiencing the world as a person of color. So I think these categories can be really problematic. And often the capturing of people's race and ethnicity can be problematic as well. It involves a lot of training of different staff in different places to ensure that people are not making assumptions about racial categories, that people are able to identify their own, that people are able to identify, you know, that they belong to, as many of us do, multiple racial categories, that they choose to not provide that information. So often what we find is that we have missing data sets or gaps in the data set, or I think that we have to supplant the data set that we do have with lots of context and lots of qualitative information that can help us better round out what the actual picture is.
All right. Well, coming up, more with our guests on what's behind the disproportionate effects of COVID-19 on racial and ethnic minorities. We'll talk about masks, we'll talk about testing, we'll talk about family leave, and we'll start taking your calls and emails. So join us at 1-800-892-6477 or by email exchange@nhpr.org. You can always use Facebook, of course. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're talking with members of the governor's COVID-19 Equity Response Team. The group examined why this virus is disproportionately affecting Granite Staters of color. We're looking at what they found and what their report recommends. And listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Join our conversation with your comments, questions. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or you can call us at 1-800-892-6477. We're with three members of the Equity Response Team this morning, Bobby Bagley, Dottie Morris, and Kirsten Dersey. And Bobby, here's an email from Michael who says, is the disparate impact in any way related to household composition like it was in Italy? Do multi-generational households or household size play a role? Michael, thank you for writing. And Bobby, what do you think?
Yes, Laura, that is a great question. And Michael, thank you for asking that question. And we did and have seen that with some of the, you know, case investigations that we've, you know, experienced with some of our families where you do have multi-generational units living in either the household or even in the apartment complex. And so we've had households where there might be one individual who is diagnosed with COVID as a positive confirmed case, and then their family members are at highest risk for contracting the disease because of the close proximity. And yes, multiple generations with grandparents there, the children, and then the grandchildren all in the household, even some where the apartment complexes are so close where there's cousins related. And so we've had that intergenerational impact of infection when it comes down to close-knit families. And so, and there's cultural components to that, right? Families that like to be together, that like to gather together. Illness and us in public health telling them to isolate or quarantine, it's not going to stop that from happening in a family that's close-knit like that. And it's not that the family members intend to expose each other or infect one another, but that's where that misinformation and that communication of how the disease is spread is important. But yes, we have seen that, and we continue to see that in the populations that we have been working with.
Yeah, great, it's question. Interesting. Yeah, and Bobby, you know, we're often told self-isolate. If you've been exposed, isolate for a time. Definitely if you're sick, you know, quarantine yourself for a long time. But, you know, in some families, that's just not practical. I remember reading advice, Bobby, like if you get COVID, you know, don't use the same bathroom as other family members. And I thought, well, I have one bathroom. What am I supposed to do? So it's not practical.
Yeah. And we do a lot of education with the families on different things that they can do, like making sure that, you know, in a household where you have, where you are sharing the same bathroom, that you wipe it down, you know, that you disinfect. And if you don't, can't get the commercial products, use, you know, bleach and water, you know, use what you can, but try to reduce the source of the infection, right? We even tell family members to wear the masks when they're at home with each other, because that will help reduce exposure of the virus to one another. And so those mitigative measures that we consider to be small things are big things when it comes to how we can all work together in our household to decrease the spread or the source of the infection. And
that's,
you're right,
interesting.
It's hard. If you don't have a big sprawling house where you can go down the hall to another room and you're all in the same space together and your common area, you know, it's a shared space, might even be the same space where, you know, you might be eating or another family member may be sleeping. It's going to be hard to separate and isolate and quarantine in that household.
Well, here's an email from Amy in Derry who says, I'm hearing generalities. How have data and situational experience informed policy in New Hampshire, Amy asks. And also, and Dottie, I'm going to throw this to you also, how much do you feel your voices were heard by Governor Sununu? Amy, thank you for writing. Go ahead, Dottie.
Well, first of all, the report was written for Governor Sununu's ears, as well as other individuals who are decision makers within the state of New Hampshire. You know, I would really like to say that. And so if you look at some of the recommendations, some of those recommendations are things that Governor Sununu can influence, or even have a major impact on. And then there are others where the responsibility is with other people within our community. So what we were trying to do with the report is basically say, this is a community effort that it will take, and it will rely on all of us to be active participants. So with that said, I think that the report has been heard, and there are several discussions taking place around some of the recommendations, especially around some of the funding areas that I brought up earlier. You know, some efforts have been made there in order to help some of those organizations. Some of the dashboards have been set up that we were requesting. And I'm sure that Kirsten could talk about that in a lot more detail than I can because of the work that she's done in that area. So yes, there have been some responses to the report beyond the governor's interventions.
So a couple things, Dottie, have already happened. Is that what you're saying? Even since in the 2 months since this was released?
Yeah, we've been having, there have been some discussions, because what has happened is now that the report is out, the governor submitted the report back to the governor's council on diversity and inclusion. And we're already taking it apart in order to try to figure out what areas need to be covered by whom, and those types of things are happening. They've already, and like I said, there's already been some discussions about additional funding, as well as I said, with the dashboards that Kirsten can talk about that we have within the state.
when you were working on all this, Dottie, and again, under a very compressed time schedule, so congratulations, you did hear stories from people, which also informed the report. And I think this gets to what Amy and Derry is writing about, you know, data and situational experience informing policy. Are there any stories, Dottie, that really jumped out from for you from your work on this report? You heard from a lot of folks.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the stories that had the greatest impact on me emotionally and provided the foundation for, I know, my commitment to the work, that wasn't just we're engaging in writing a report. I would think that all five of us are very invested in this beyond just providing a report that will sit on a shelf and collect dust. But one of the stories I heard was from a person who has a small nonprofit who provides a lot of support within her community. And she was literally having people knock on her door asking for help. And without the funding, it was very hard for her to do it. So she was dipping into her own pocket because she couldn't allow for individuals in her community who had grown to trust her and be able to offer counsel in so many ways. She couldn't allow for them not to have what they needed because some folks had lost their jobs. Some people couldn't go to work. There were a variety of things that prevented them from getting that. And just hearing the story and hearing her commitment to it, I could not want to do something. I felt so compelled by that story and her devotion and dedication. And so I think that deepened my conviction that something had to be done, and it has to be done immediately.
Yeah, Kirsten, what about you? Again, your work on this team, and it was a small team, five people, wasn't just the five of you, you know, sort of looking at the data and saying, here's what we think needs to happen. You heard from many people. What story in particular, Kirsten, jumped out at you as you worked on this?
You know, it was a small team, and we had a very compressed period of time. And I think that one thing that we emphasized in the report, as a high level need of a critical nature, was to be able to expand the ability to capture more community voice, to hear more stories. And so I really appreciate Amy's question about what do the individual stories tell us along with the data. I mean, we did hear lots of stories like it was a public process, and so we were able to open up and have people provide information and provide testimony and provide their stories. We heard stories about people fearing that they wouldn't have access to testing or being concerned about being out in public. We heard stories, as Dottie reflected, about people's ability to access resources, to be able to help their own communities. There were a multitude of stories, but I think the reality is that we haven't heard enough. And we really emphasize this in the report that we were five people. We are intensely dedicated for both personal and professional reasons to this work, but that there were people who came before us. There are going to be people who come after us doing the work. And there are people right now who have stories to tell, and we need to bear witness to those stories and find a way to hear them.
You know, Bobby, another theme that I saw again and again in this report is trust and sometimes the lack thereof in public organizations. And I wonder what you think, how has lack of trust in government in some communities contributed to the trends that we're looking at, whether it's, you know, masks or testing or whatever?
Well, Laura, that's a really good question. And it takes me back to the conversation earlier on where we were talking about data. When you're asking people to provide, you know, certain information, people, there are fears about what's going to be done with that information. Even when you're collecting race and ethnicity data, and this stems back to, again, you know, the history of institutional racism that has existed, and knowing a person's racial ethnic background and fears of well, what's going to be done with that information? What's going to happen to me? And so if we have members in our community that don't trust when that information is being collected and used in a way that's going to benefit them, it's going to be difficult to collect that information, right? And so for, you know, with the testing and having people isolate or quarantine, those are things that can really impact a person's life tremendously, especially for individuals where they may be the sole household earner of income, and then we're telling them not to go to work for 14 days or 10 days. And we're not providing them with any income to substantiate them being able to buy food or pay for their rent. How much are they going to trust us at that level? And so that trust stems, you know, across a number of different factors for folks, because we've got to make sure that we can provide resources for people when we're asking them to do these things, when we're asking the community to help us protect each other and one another. We've got to give resources to that community for them to be able to do that. And they've got to be able to trust that we're going to be there for them when they reach out. And so when people call and ask for information, we've got to have information that's correct. We've got to have resources that we can connect folks to that they can rely upon. And that all builds trust. And Kirsten talked about the resiliency that we want to see and that we have seen in our communities. We were able to see that through some of the responses that came from some of our nonprofit and community-based organizations in supporting the community and helping build that trust and build that resiliency. United Way had volunteers that were out, you know, our city and both Manchester, Nashville, and across the state, you know, our nonprofit organizations really came together to work to help our population groups and community members get the resources that they need. But what, again, we found was there's more that's needed. And that's why the data is so important and the resources, because then it allows us to see where our gaps exist, in particular for our most marginalized population groups that are our racial and ethnic minority populations.
Well, coming up, I'd like to ask all of you a little bit more about those workplace issues that you mentioned, Bobby. It's one thing to ask somebody to self-isolate. It's the other thing if they are the sole breadwinner and don't have, leave or sick time or anything like that. We'll take a lot more of your emails, too. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, members of the governor's COVID-19 equity response team join us on the results of their wide-ranging report on how this pandemic has disproportionately affected Granite State minority residents. We'd love to hear from you, Exchange listeners. Now, as always, our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 1-800-892-6477. The team had 5 members. We're with 3 of them: Kirsten Dersey, Bobby Bagley, and Dottie Morris. And Dottie, to you, Bobby talked about trust before the break, not just that the health recommendations are correct, that testing is important, that if someone is asked to self-isolate after exposure or infection, they'll be able to survive. And I'd love your thoughts on that. There's some real economic stresses and strains that you heard from folks who needed to not be at work and they had to be at work.
Right. And I think that because of, some of the things that were happening early on, either you went to work because, you know, just imagine if you work an hourly job and the only way that you can accrue sick time is one particular way and your organization doesn't offer that, you could see why people felt compelled to go to work even if they were sick or either felt guilty if they couldn't go to work because they can't support their families. So some of the mechanisms that were put in place in order to support those kind of systems or individuals is very important. It was very important to put those in place. The other thing is, what is the work environment like? Is there enough is their capacity to have the physical distancing along with the mask necessary. So if you were working at supermarkets, for example, prior to a lot of the pieces that were put in place to protect the workers, people were being exposed to situations that put them at higher risk of contracting the disease. So what we have to do is look at those work environments, look at some of the policies and procedures in place so people don't feel that they have to go to work. And if, because it's hard to choose between work and food, you know, and being well, because you could be well or get to be well, but if you don't have the food, or if your family doesn't have the food to be nurtured, then, you know, there's another problem. So I think that that's why we were looking at so many different moving parts that were interlocking parts that had an impact on people's quality of life.
Well, I want to ask you about masks, and Bobby, I'll turn to you first. The report says New Hampshire should have mask mandates in areas it calls with high infection rates and high risk situations. So you're not calling for one statewide, but in those areas, again, with high infection rates and high risk situations. So just give us a few examples, Bobby, please, of what those places might be.
So, I mean, in areas where New Hampshire is a rural state, and we do have our urban centers, right? And so in places, you know, like up north where you can really distance, social distancing is easier. You don't need to have a mask mandate unless, you know, you end up in situations or scenarios where you're in a public space and you're gonna come up close to folks less than 6 feet apart from them. But in areas where it is more crowded, in areas where there's more density of population, and in areas where the data, again, going back to why it's important for us to know where infection is, where we have the numbers, those are the areas where you want to have a mask mandate, or you want to make sure that people are wearing masks, because that is one of the simplest ways and cheapest ways of reducing the source or spread of those respiratory droplets. And so we don't need to have a statewide mandate, but we do need to have mask mandated in places where we know there's large numbers of people congregating together, and it could be at an event. So if up north, if there's an event that's going on and there's going to be large numbers of people crowded together, they should have masks on the entire time that they're engaged in that activity or that they're around other people, because that, again, is a good way of reducing source of spread.
Kirsten, another recommendation is widespread community testing. What is the latest on this, Kirsten? How widespread is testing at this point, and how much are people taking advantage of it?
You know, I think there has been a significant amount of testing made available in lots of communities. There were stood up by the state testing sites in multiple communities, and Bobby could speak significantly to the testing that was available in Nashua and has been done at the community level as well. I think that, you know, as the pandemic moves forward, testing services will modify to meet the needs. That said, I think that we still have significant gaps for where our testing services are available, where they've been made available, how we're outreaching to communities to make sure that people understand that it's a safe place to come and have a test. And so I think there's a lot of work to be done in this area.
So more communication, Kirsten, you know, the gaps you mentioned. Yeah, go ahead.
I think more communication is critical, where testing is available, what that testing process looks like or will look like, how reliable is the testing, what are the different types of, there's just a lot of information that I think has, I think we've all sort of experienced information overload. Even those of us who work, you know, very closely in the response to this pandemic, I think are experiencing information overload. And I think it can be very difficult for people to determine what's good information, what's not good information, what information can they trust, what can they not trust. And so, you know, I think that the best that we can do is to uncomplicate the issue, decomplicate the issue, to provide as much information out directly to communities from safe, reliable, trusted sources. For instance, Bobby, in her work in the Nashua Health Department, they have a very, very close relationship with the community that they serve. They're a trusted source of information. And so that's a wonderful route for providing information out to the community and providing services. We talked early on about the use of community health workers and outreach workers into the community who come from the community and move back into the community to do work, and they carry information back and forth. And that's an important aspect of providing information out that we really can enhance. There is some work going on in that area. So, we're hopeful that that will just continue to get better and better.
Taylor wrote us an email asking, can the guests speak to how much of this equity work falls on the shoulders of those in marginalized groups? And Dottie, I'll put that one to you. It's a big question.
That's a great question. And thanks for stomping me on it. It's such a complicated issue, because some of it does fall on those of us in those marginalized groups, like Kirsten said, to, work within communities where we live and work and play, where people do trust us. So it's very important for us to engage in, providing accurate information within that group. It also, for those of us who live, work, and play in areas where we don't have a large percentage of people representing underrepresented groups, for us to carry the story there as well, and to hold those particular groups that we're working for, individuals that we're living close to hold them accountable as well. I think it will take all of us to be able to figure this out. People from marginalized groups, people from dominantly identified groups, to come together and work this out. Because I think Bobby mentioned it earlier, is that we're also interrelated. And I think that that's the thing that falls short sometimes, in us realizing what affects one person affects another person. So in order for us to figure this out, for us to get out of the situation that we're in, it'll take collective voices working on this and being able to have an impact on how things are done, when things are done, where things are done, and to what degree we need to do things. So I think it'll take all of the voices, so dominant group people and people who are from the underrepresented groups, coming together, and most of all voices being honored. I think that in the past, when I think about diversity and multiculturalism, those voices around the table are critical to like someone once told me, we're dealing with complex issues that will take compound answers. So we need to have multiple voices and those voices to be heard. What we've fallen short is we'll create these situations, but disenfranchised voices or underrepresented voices are not heard and not considered in coming up with a solution. So that's a very good question. I'll be thinking about it all day.
Well, what's the next step? Dottie, I'll go to you first, but everybody, what's the next step for this team after you've done this work?
Well, one of the next steps will be to work with the Governor's Council on Diversity and Inclusion to kind of refine the recommendations. And one of the recommendations in the report is to formalize this group of and expand it from 5 to several more people, so we could do some of the things that were mentioned before, dig a little deeper into the data, and then to come up with some really fine-tuned specific recommendations as sub-recommendations under the larger umbrella of recommendations that we have. So in my mind, that's the next step, is to once again reinforce those. But first, we'd have to it would be a good idea to formalize this group.
Wow. And how about you, Bobby? What would you like to see for the next step, in addition to what Dottie mentioned?
So in addition, Laura, to what Dottie mentioned, this, we put this out as an initial report, which means it's just the beginning.
Sure.
And it's the beginning and the middle of something that had already started decades ago. So we've been working on trying to close gaps with disparities, trying to dispel myths trying to work on institutional and structural racism for decades. And so this report is an initial or beginning step for us in New Hampshire to collectively work on this together, marginalized, unmarginalized, majority, minority, everyone to work on this together. Because what this report has done, just as COVID has done, is that it's opened our eyes for many who may not have been able to see this for whatever reason of short-sightedness. But now this has opened the eyes of many, you know, from the governor's office all the way down to our, you know, community members and other community partners. So next steps are to engage our leadership at all levels, at the local level, you know, at the state level, in looking at the high-level peer pillars that we identified and the 64 different recommendations, and looking at our local level and in our communities to see what of those can we start working at or start working on at the same time at the governor's level or at the state level. Some of these recommendations are being worked on again. So you're having a collective from the ground level up and top level down till we come together in the middle to address what needs to happen with closing these gaps and disparities.
All right. Well, all of you, we're going to wrap it up there for today, but we will stay in touch on these issues for sure. And Bobby, it was really nice to talk to you again. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for
having me. Thank you, Laura.
That's Bobby Bagley, Director of Public Health and Community Services in Nashua. Kirsten Dersey, too, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Kirsten Dersey, evaluator for the Bureau of Infectious Disease in the New Hampshire Division of Public Health. And Dottie, always good to talk to you, too. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you one more time. And we'll pedal to the metal on this.
That's Dottie Morris, Associate Vice President for Diversity and Inclusion at Keene State College. Today's show was produced by Senior Producer Ellen Grimm. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.